Okay, so we're all back. I'm gonna have to speed through the rest now. Because we spent so much time. And I'm just gonna quickly recap the information about images.
Actually, do you have the mic?
I'm wearing it.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. So I'm gonna quickly recap the images at the end of the multimedia section. Just for our friends who aren't with us right now in this room. Okay, so audio. Quickly, formats for audio. I'm putting WAV and AIFF in the same category. Actually, just let me write down the main file formats to remember. Okay. So the reason why I put WAV and AIFF in the same category is that they're both basically, you don't need to know what it is, but PCM-based and uncompressed, largest, nicest, purest audio files that you'll probably work with. WAV is just what you would use if you're in Windows. AIFF is what you would tend to use if you were in a Macintosh environment. It's not exclusive. You can definitely work with and edit an AIFF in Windows. Same for WAV. It's just that's where they tend to be associated with. And if you were burning a music CD, you'd be saving files as a WAV or AIFF first, and then burning them to a CD, as opposed to MP3, which is a compressed format. And it does lose data from a WAV or AIFF format. Basically, way to compare the two is if you would say that it's about 1 megabyte per minute for an MP3, it's about 10 megabytes per minute. Actually, it might be a little high there, but I mean, you could think about it basically as being 10 times bigger than an MP3, if that makes any sense at all. Main thing to remember, sorry. PCM is just a technology. It's a way of encoding data. So again, you won't need to know what PCM is for the exam, but it's just that's the technology that's involved. Main thing to remember about AAS is that it's the lossless audio format. And where you might use it, say for your audio track for your video, if that makes any sense, just to get nice, pure, clean sound. Also because you may go through many compressions of your video. CDDA is the file format that you'd find on, like, say, a commercial CD when they're encoding everything. Hence why you need the ripping software, why you can't just take the info and take it from the CD and just plop it onto your computer. Other key things to think about for audio, you have bit rate. And you'll probably recognize this at like 92 kbps, 128. And that's basically just data per second that's coming out. This applies both to audio quality and also to when you're streaming audio over the internet. Basically, the higher the kbps required, sort of the faster the data connection that you'll need. So that's why you'll have like low, mid, high bandwidths, and it'll be like 92, 128, and the higher this number, the higher the data connection you'll need in order to have a smooth, seamless internet stream over the radio. You also have kilohertz, which applies to several, not just audio, applies to a whole bunch of different types of things that exist. It's a physics thing, I believe. But typically you'll see things such as 44.1 kilohertz, etc. That also relates back to the audio quality, the quality of an audio file. No, it's not the size. I want to say that it relates back to the waveform, because audio is basically waves. Even though digitally it's pulses, the signal is being related as like zeros and ones. Audio starts and finishes as waves. So, and basically, if you think about it, your processors are measured in hertz. You know, that's a cycle, wave cycle, if you think about it that way. So, mainly, I guess the only reason why this might want to remember this kind of number is most MP3s that you'll see will be 128 kilobits per second at 44.1 kilohertz. I mean, that's just one thing to think of, why you might want to even remember those numbers. And now, not to be confusing, you'll see those numbers when you're dealing with video as well. Main thing is they just basically tie back to quality for both audio and video. Generally, the higher the numbers, the higher the quality, and the better your bandwidth has to be in order to stream it smoothly. Basically, when things are streamed, they're streamed as like podcasts, for example, or you might have heard of like shoutcast radio, but it's not like a specific audio file format. It's a data stream that's going on, not necessarily file formats that are being sent out over the internet. Does that make sense at all? Mm-hmm. So, no, it's all right. I mean, I guess the way to think about it is they're optimized for streaming, so it's compressed, it's packaged in a way that streaming it would be, it's encoded in such a way that you can stream it. But you wouldn't just sit there. I mean, you could technically, quote unquote, stream, say, an MP3 by embedding it into your web page. Technically, that's a stream. But normally, the way you would stream something is through, like for a continuous stream, you'd probably want to stream it as a podcast. But if you're embedding something, yeah, you could embed like an MP3 or a MIDI file into your website. And once, if someone opened your page and started hearing the music, that would technically count as a stream. Does that make any sense at all? Does that help? So yeah, I mean, I guess technically there is the real media family with its real media, which, for anyone who's lost on that, real media is a type of media player. Plays different file formats, Winamp, Windows Media Player, iTunes. Those are all different types of media players. And actually, these days, there's not much difference between your audio player and your video player. They tend to be like all capable of doing all of them now. So, might as well go to video. So as was mentioned, there's the real formats that the real company puts out. WMV is released by Microsoft, and it stands for Windows Media Video. QuickTime is released by Apple. And it has its own player, QuickTime player. And these, I guess, would be streamable videos. Like you might, you could embed it, or you could tap into a website, or someone could click on it, and it would open up a player and then start playing. In terms of something that you would want to edit in, there's AVI, or DV. Both can usually be source. I call them source files because they sort of correspond to the WAV AIFF. So AVI to WAV, DV to AIFF. So if you're editing video, these would have the most information, and you could compress down easily from there, as opposed to trying to go back up to here. And it's what you'll get when you're importing video to your desktop. Other formats that you might see is MPEG-2. This was where people might have gotten tripped up on the problem set, because this is typically the file format for DVDs. There's certainly many other kinds of MPEG files. In fact, MP3 stands for MPEG layer 1, MPEG layer 3. La, 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 la. It's one of the MPEGs. So not just video, it can be audio, but MPEG-2 happens to be for DVD. Lately, when you're on YouTube or Google Video, you might see, SWF is Shockwave, which comes from Flash. And lately, all those videos you see on YouTube, etc., will tend to be Flash files, basically. So sometimes you might see it as FLV. There's definitely way more video file formats, but these two, for, you know, if you're internet or you're just wanting to share, these two for like editing or large files. I guess to get a sense of how big video is versus audio, I've had files where 1 minute, I think like 10 minutes corresponds to a gig. So 1 gigabyte of space would correspond to about 10 minutes of video. So it takes up a lot of space. Compression for video. So David mentioned inter versus intra. And if you have, basically video consists of frames. And we sort of just trick ourselves into thinking that these frames are moving. When you're compressing using intra, basically the computer says, okay, the background is the same all across, but there's only one thing that's moving. So it'll just be like, okay, same background no matter what, the only information that I have to remember that's changing is this moving object. And so that's one way it cuts down on having to save a lot of information. When you have inter, it's sort of thinking, okay, well, there's not much difference between, say, frames 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. So what I'll do is I'll cut out 2, 4, 6, and I'll allow the human eye to sort of make up or fill in the gaps.
Does it cut it out or just play one longer?
It kind of cuts it out. It drops it. Drops it out. So then that's another way of saving the amount, reducing the amount of information that has to be stored. I can't say, you know, this is better than that one. It just sort of depends on what you're doing. So if you're doing something where, you know, you have a talking head, so nothing's really moving except for, like, the mouth. Well, no. Let me just repeat that. If someone stays standing still for a really long time, and you're staring at them for like 5 seconds, this would probably be a better thing to do because they're just standing there. Your eye is going to just sort of remember what they look like standing there. But if, say, someone's running across what looks like the same black wall, then this is going to be a lot better because there's only one object moving. Your mind's going to remember what the background looks like anyways. So in that case, this would be a better compression technique. For anyone who's an animation fiend, it kind of can go back into the whole thing about frames and keyframes. Because the way keyframes usually work is that their main points of change. So you might want to say this is keyframe one, and this is keyframe two. All that's really important is to remember this and that, and we'll just sort of calculate all the information in between. So all this information in between is either repetitious or can be sort of like reduced to set up, but the main frames are this one and that one, because that's the main point of change. So to recap on everything, image files. We have the GIFs, the JPEGs, and the PNGs. GIFs being, again, the ones that can handle transparency, better if you have fewer colors, and it's lossless. JPEGs being the one that can handle a wider color palette, but they are lossy, and they're better for photographs. PNGs sort of being the hybrid of the two, because it can handle the wide color range of JPEGs, but it's lossless like GIFs, can handle transparencies. Plus, if you resize it, it won't lose data and have that funny quality loss. For high-res PSDs, which are Photoshop files, the TIFF, which is the tagged image file format, and then RAW, sort of like the pure data that your camera might capture before you convert it to another file format. Resolution being your sort of number of pixels available. Further breakdownable into the whole dots per inch. So the higher your dots per inch, the more dots you have in your overall image, and therefore the higher your resolution can be. Compression, sort of just being a way of packing in your data. Lossy being the loss of information, data in during the process of packing. Lossless meaning that no data gets lost during the packing. All of the audio formats, the bitrate and the kilohertz. Streamable audio with the real media. Also, you can embed different file formats. Video, being you can have real media, Windows Media Video, QuickTime, AVI, MPEG-2, Flash. Sorry, I'm just trying to zoom through so we can get to security and everything else that you'll need to know. Are there any final questions when it comes to multimedia? I would say for the exam, focus on the images, on the focus on information regarding images, regarding graphics. He touched on, if you remember from the lecture, video was touched on perhaps the next most, and then audio was kind of barely touched upon. So if you're looking for priorities, focus on graphics.
Where did that, was it that kind of fall on the priorities?
Vectors and bitmaps would fall into graphics.
Right.
And thank you for remembering. I'd say the main thing to remember is the whole vectors being calculations of a path versus bitmaps being actual remembering pixels. And just remembering that pixels are representations of colors as dots using zeros and ones. Any last minute questions? All right, we're gonna get rid of all this. And hopefully zoom through part of security with me and then the rest of security with Ray. So I guess we're gonna start with privacy. That's the first thing to think about in terms of privacy are forms. Has everyone used a form before on a website? It's basically whenever you're on a web page and they want to know your name, your date of birth, your password, all that good information that you want to save. Basically, precautions to take into consideration are, is it a mainstream site? Did it just give you the option to call in and interact with a live human being, although maybe you really don't want to? Why would you think about this? Forms are a means by which people can steal your personal information by sniffing it out, by catching it in the middle because, you know, someone could pose as a server. They'll grab your information as it's getting sent out and then go from their server onto the actual server that it's going supposed to go through. Sometimes the information gets stored in your RAM. So, you know, if someone really dug hard, they could find it. Also, spyware that's hiding out on your computer could be catching the information and passing it on to somewhere else. And, you know, there are companies that are starting to store information for you so that you don't have to remember it all the time. But, you know, problem is someone could either get into their servers or so on and so forth. Ways to check for secureness is it using SSL encryption? It's just a encrypting technology. Supposedly makes it more secure. Sometimes you can see the SSL certificate. The other thing is there's the HTTPS. So you'll notice a page will suddenly change to saying HTTPS instead of just the regular HTTP. Sometimes you'll see on a website in the corner the little padlock. Used to always mean, yes, this is a secure website. Unfortunately, now you can sort of fudge it in. So like a webmaster could make it look, have it appear, but it might not actually be secure. So hopefully, if you see all three, you're fine. But those are the three main ways usually to check for secureness. Yes? The padlock. What do you mean? Like, how do you see that? Oh, okay.
Probably all three, so how do you see that?
Again, sometimes on the page somewhere it says, you know, using SSL encryption. I think sometimes you can see some sort of indication in this little, in the bottom of your browser, because this is where, you know, some different pieces of information flash up. Sometimes you'll see it there. Okay, so as Ray stated, depending on the browser, you can double click on the padlock. Yes. Sorry, any other questions? All right, so that was forms. So moving on to cookies. Basic definition of cookies, they're a file that a website that you have visited saves on your computer so that Ideally, it's so that, you know, next time you visit it, it remembers all this information about your preferences, or it saves other pieces of information for the website so that it loads faster. It's more customized each time that you go back. And technically, only the website that saves this file can use that cookie on your computer. Sort of the nice thing is that it can store random numbers, your username, your regular name, and your preferences. Fortunately, I think it can, well, instead of password, it will save a large random number. And then, you know, it'll look up that number, and then, because that correlates to your password, it'll just move forward that way. So technically, a cookie is supposed to make things convenient for you every time you visit a website.
None of that is at Amazon. Amazon just knows to look in my computer for what I bought last time. That's what I can't get I'm not sure where the information is. Do they just, they know it's me. They say, hi, Christine, here's what you might be interested in. Is that because they've stored it on my computer?
I want to say no, only because I think if you log out of your account, it wouldn't still, that information still might not necessarily pop up. So like, because the thing is, if you move to another computer and logged in as yourself, it would still remember everything you'd bought and what you might like.
Then what is the cookie saving?
The cookie would be saving things like, well, one thing is it would help Amazon load up a little faster. Another thing is like your email address. So like if you, when you want to log into Amazon, it might store your username.
Okay.
That sort of thing.
Could
I only hesitate to say that it does that exactly because there's also because the browsers these days will also do things like save information for you. So I don't want to say that it definitely does that. That's what's going on because sometimes it is the browser that's saving the information.
Right, but it could be.
It could be. Yeah, you could, technically. Mainly you would remember things like preferences. So say first time you went to a website and it wanted to know, do you like your website blue? Do you like it in the blue background as opposed to the red background? Do you like it with the nav bar over here as opposed to there? I mean, if a website was customizable like that, a cookie could remember those kind of things for you so that you wouldn't have to reorganize everything all the time.
So all the stuff about what I bought that's saved somewhere in their server, but they look at my cookie, they see who I am, and then they find the file on their server. Does it work? If I sign on at work, I'm sure Amazon has also put something in my computer at work, because when I turn it on, I get the same, here's what you ordered last time, here's what you might like. It's not like terribly different, but obviously they're different machines, they're not hooked together. So there must be something on Amazon.
In that case, it would be information tied to your account that's saved on their servers that is being pulled up every time you log in,
okay.
Kind of like your email account.
So they're just finding who I am and because they know who I am.
Not necessarily in this case. In this case, you might want to think of it more as like whenever you're logging into your email. Does that make more sense? Yeah, okay, so in that case, think of that more like log into your email. But yeah, I mean, I tend to think of cookies as being more like the website remembers that you were there, so it can load up faster. And if you had like strange interface preferences or other certain pieces of information regarding your username or your account, that kind of information would probably be stored in that cookie. The main thing is in terms of how it relates to security, the problem is that if you're, say, at like CNN.com, where there's like lots of different companies with like ads and just other third-party companies, they can put save cookies on your computer as well and use information from that. So then what those kind of cookies might do is say, oh, it notices that you really, you know, you tend to go to these kind of ads, so it'll propagate more of those ads. Or it can also store your information to and use that against you. So really, in terms of security, the problem with cookies is that you can't really designate who saves cookies unless you say, you know, I mean, you can go into your internet options in Internet Explorer or something and say, you know, don't allow websites that require cookies. But so many websites, a lot of mainstream websites do require it. So kind of thing is just to be smart about it and just be aware that this could, you know, that there are many companies that are possibly saving cookies on your computer without you realizing it.
Because then, like, if I figured out where CNN saves the cookie on my machine,
well, you
start poking around and see what other things.
Well, I mean, the cookies are stored in a default location on your hard drive, and you do have the option of deleting cookies from your hard drive. You have that flexibility, and I believe you could technically go in and like open up the cookie file. So, it's not like it's hidden. It's just they openly say we are now saving a cookie in this spot. But yes, you can definitely go in and find the cookies file. You just do a search for cookies if you're in Windows, and you can delete them all, and you can poke around with them. So I guess both sides are taking a risk when they're putting cookies. It's just a lot of people aren't aware that it's happening. So that kind of information storage relates to logs. And logs sort of stores data about visits to a website. And it can remember characteristics such as what hours of the day are most popular, what domains people are coming from, maybe even what search terms are being used to get to that website. Basically just all sorts of information about the people who are coming, so your operating system, your browser, that sort of thing. I mean, technically used in a good way, logs are used to determine who the audience is and how to improve the website. On the bad side, you know, someone could use that information to try to, you know, create a piece of malicious software or something based on those statistics. So forms sort of relate to cookies, sort of feedback into logs, if you want to think about it that way. All three sort of affect your privacy. Speaking of privacy, we all use passwords. Typical tips for making a secure password is, you know, combination of letters and numbers, capitals and lowercase, try not to use dictionary words. Ray just mentioned that you can now use compound characters in Windows, which would be something like a heart shape or a diamond shape, like an actual symbol, to make it even harder. So passwords, another way of protecting yourself. The more complicated you can make it, the better. But if you really, really have to, write it down on a piece of paper and put that in a safe place. Because you don't want to make it too safe so that you can't even remember it. Quickie on wireless. Basically, there's two... Two wireless encryptions. There's WEP, which is Wired Equivalency Protocol, which is now quote-unquote broken. Not so secure. So now more places you'll see will use WPA or WPA2, which is technically more secure, but in general, your wired connection will probably be safer than your wireless, and particularly if you're like in a coffee shop. The main thing is, if you're browsing wireless networks and you see like, look, it's an unsecured network. I don't need to enter a password. How great. I have an internet connection. Well, that means anyone else can also hop onto there and start possibly packet sniffing your computer. And packet sniffing is using software to sort of sniff out the TCP/IP packets that your computer is sending and receiving. And the problem there is if those packets contain, you know, certain information that you don't want anyone else to find out, then that information could be used against you. Other ways of getting information from you would be phishing. So those funny emails that you sometimes receive from official-looking companies, characteristics are the email address. If it's a really complicated, mumbly-jumbly, and it's not even the company name.com, or if it's like the company name dot some other set of words .com, chances are it's not really from that company. And literally, it will look that jumbly. Another thing is you don't even have an account with them. Spelling or grammatical errors, them insisting that you must provide them with your username, your password, and your credit card, and your firstborn child, telling you to click on a link. You can always check out the link that they put in there, because as you might have learned from doing XHTML now, technically what the actual link is could be very different from what the text says. So that's another thing to check out. And also, just if you do have an account with that company and you might be a little worried, don't click on that link. Go to the actual website, like type it into the browser URL window, and go in and log in there. Because sometimes it will direct you to either a site that looks really a lot like the company website, or it will actually direct you to the website, but it'll have it sort of like filtered so that it can catch information on the way during transmission. So in a way, this is sort of hacking. Hacking has a funny history. Basically, some people view hacking as trying to break into where you're not supposed to be. Over at MIT, it's playing practical jokes. But usually, hacking is not very nice. But phishing could be considered one way of hacking. Just constantly trying to try different passwords on someone's email account could be considered hacking. Trying to steal a data connection that's not yours could be a form of hacking. So basically breaking in where you don't really belong sort of is a hacking. So the final bit that I'm going to talk about are virus versus worms versus Trojans and spyware really quickly. So virus is sort of the basic, just malicious software. That malicious, well, that may or may not do something to your computer. Ideally, it's going to try to do something to your computer, and ideally in the sense of the person who made the virus. And ideally, it'll make your computer sick, just like a regular virus in real life. Unfortunately, they're usually so buggy that they don't always work. If anything, it could possibly take up a lot of your CPU power and your RAM. And an example of a famous virus in the past 2 years would be the Melissa virus. So anyone who wants to do extra research, the Melissa, maybe you might have had it. Next down would be worms. They're a little scarier because they sort of run through the internet of their own accord. They can do it through email, through networks. And again, they kind of try to do what viruses do, but again, they don't need any humans in order to run. And plus, they jump from computer to computer. And the one that everyone might have remembered recently would have been the blaster worm, which was so drastic it required some people to basically wipe their hard drives and start over. And then there's Trojans, which, just like the Greek mythology, sort of hide out on your computer. And, you know, sometimes people will set a trigger date so it just hides there, and then, you know, one day all of a sudden all the processes on your computer are running wonky. They can be sent through email. Actually, viruses and Trojans and worms can all be sent through email, through instant messaging, anything that requires the internet, basically. And if you want to look up a famous Trojan, they're so big. Kind of relates to spyware, because spyware also likes to hide out on your computer, just lurking there until it can do something bad. Do you want to take over, Ray? Whew. Now that everyone's running.
Everybody get that? So we know about common defenses against bad things, viruses, adware, spyware, so on and so forth. One of those might be a firewall. Another might be antivirus. And another, that's not really a user tool. That's kind of interesting. Technically speaking, that's a double-edged sword. I read, sorry to go on a tangent, everybody in internet land, he just asked about the virtual machine. I read somewhere that the next evolution for viruses would be to actually virtualize your instance of Windows so that you're running Windows in a virtual machine and you wouldn't even detect that there was a virus on there because it's running outside your instance of Windows. So, double-edged sword. Scanners. Like we talked about port scanning, packet sniffing. This is host-based. This is something that's happening on your computer where a host is really just some computer out there. This is network-based. So for example, one thing you might...
Which network-based?
Port scanning and packet scanning, sniffing. For example, one thing you may or may not wish to do, let's say you are an administrator of a local area network, you might want to do a random port scan of all the machines that you're responsible for, let's say the 40 or 50 PCs in the lab downstairs, just to make sure that nobody's running some spyware, adware, something or another that's trying to phone home. And data scrubbing is a good defense. David talked about when you're ready to move on from your old computer to a newer computer and you want to give it away, throw it away, something or another. We handed out that article in class about how so often, unfortunately too often, personal data, important data, SSNs from your tax returns that you did on Quicken, is just readable from hard drives, even though you might have reformatted them. One way you can really scrub the data is using a tool called DBAN, Derek's Boot and Nuke. we have several videos of the week devoted to various firewall and antivirus software. So I would encourage you all, especially those of you in internet land, to go ahead and take a look at our videos of the week page on the course website and give those a once over. Any questions about these?
Or these are hardware too, but that's usually for maybe a large server or something like that, not your personal computer.
Maybe not a server, but a network of servers. The question was, we've heard about certain firewalls that are hardware-based as opposed to software-based. What's the context that they would be used for? Maybe in larger institutions where you have a lot of hosts to protect. So I'm going a little quickly here. Do feel free to stop me anytime. We're going to talk about web development now.
Right.
Yes. For your computer, the typical PC user or Mac user, the typical personal computer user, will use a software-based firewall. The one that comes by default with Windows XP, for example, is software. Other popular ones for Windows are Zone Alarm. McAfee now comes bundled with them, its own version of a firewall, so does Symantec. XHTML, extensible HarpyText markup language, it's a step above, we like to think, HTML, regular old HTML. In an XHTML page, you have a certain anatomy. At the top, you have a DTD, and then you have the actual markup. That markup has two distinct parts, the head and the body. The markup that goes here in the body is what actually renders in the browser screen. XHTML documents are composed of elements. More popularly, folks like to refer to them as tags. So a tag, for example, the paragraph tag, this is my paragraph. So all elements have a certain anatomy. I'm just using the paragraph element as an example. You always have a start tag, you always have an end tag, and the content goes in between. If we had an anchor tag, for example, a equals we have our start tag. This is our element name. This is an attribute. What's between the quotes is the value of the attribute, the content, and the end tag. All elements in XHTML must have an end tag. Well, just like with English, there's always an exception to the rule, and that exception is singletons. So there exist elements where it doesn't make sense to have a start tag and an end tag, for example, the line break. While that might be technically correct, it doesn't make sense to use this format because there's nothing that should go in between. What kind of content would you put at a line break? So in XHTML, we use this format. Similarly for images, it doesn't make sense to put anything here. It doesn't make sense to start your image tag and then end it, because the content is the image itself. You're not going to put anything right in the middle of it. Yes?
So back there you have the A is the element, href is the...
This is the attribute. This is the value. So that's the...
A is the what?
Attribute.
A is the...
I'm sorry. A is the element. I'm sorry. You're right. I'm out in la-la land, sorry.
And then what's the attribute?
Href is the attribute. This is the attribute, this is the element. That's the value.
No, I mean, what do they mean?
There are around about 90-some-odd elements for XHTML, and we won't go through them for the purposes of this review because they're just, I mean, even if we were just to list them out loud, that would take the rest of the time. So I would suggest if you were curious about a particular element, go to the sections page and follow the link to the XHTML reference on w3schools.com. Yes. Right, right. The question is, an element can have many attributes. Yes, some of them do. Some of them, for valid XHTML, must take on many attributes. Some of them don't. This is the value of the attribute. Element, attribute equals value. I'm going to start erasing this so we can cover cascading style sheets. So also extremely relevant for web development is cascading style sheets. This is another syntax to learn, particularly important to you guys because it's required for the final project. But what this helps to do is separate content from presentation. So if you have a given page, an open letter to Santa Claus for the holidays. We want the content, the actual words that are going to appear in the page, to be in the XHTML document. But if we wanted to prettify it, apply certain fonts, apply certain sizing, apply certain background colors, background images, text colors, other behaviors, we want to separate that out into its own, at least for the final project, its own external style sheet. So let's talk about styles. Or properties. In a style sheet, using this example, I mean, we have a paragraph here. If I wanted to affect a change on that paragraph, I would indicate the element, and then within curly brackets, whatever styles that I wanted to apply. The format of those styles would be, for example, font, family, colon, sans, serif. And one reason we might want to do that is so that the default font of Times New Roman doesn't come up here, but sans serif, or Arial, or Verdana or whatever you wanted to put in there. You can apply multiple styles to a given property. You can apply multiple selectors to a given property. By multiple selectors, we mean I don't want this just to apply to paragraphs, but also headings, for example. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. If if for the sake of being festive in my letter to Santa, I have one paragraph here, and then I start another paragraph here, I can either apply a class or an ID to each of these paragraphs and then have a separate rule for that. So for example, if in my XHTML here, instead of just a plain old P tag, I said P class equals fancy. And here I said E class equals fancy 2. I could have P dot fancy. This is my selector. This is the class that I'm specifying with my attribute. And let's say color red. And then I can specify p.fancy2 and say color green. And then I've got a super festive holiday letter for Santa.
You're going to set up these style sheets separate, and then you're going to reference within the XHTML page or within that web page that style sheet.
Right.
So then it pulls that style sheet and applies it.
Right.
So you only have to change one reference if you have 32 style sheets.
Right, exactly.
And classes.
Right. So for the sake of those of you in internet land, the first question was, in your XHTML page, you make reference to your style sheet, which I suppose I should draw an arrow this direction. That style, the browser knows then to apply the rules of the style sheet to this page. The second question was, you can use classes to differentiate between like elements. I have two paragraphs here, so I'm using the P tag, but I'm specifying a class to apply different style or different property behavior to this paragraph and this paragraph.
If you don't have multiple behaviors for an element, you can just reference it as P on the style sheet with
right.
curly brackets, and then when you're referencing it in the HTML, do you have to say a class, or do you just
no, it would.
Right,
right. So the question is, if I didn't want to do something fancy like that, I can just have P vanilla, and I can just use P vanilla, no attribute or value. Sure. Other web technologies that it's important to at least be able to recognize. Oops. We're going to take a quick break so our videographer can change the tape, and then we'll finish this in 5 minutes or less. Now we're back, and we're going to finish this up really quickly. Other web technologies that it's important to at least recognize for the exam: Document Object Model, or DOM. You should just be able to recognize the acronym. JavaScript. Please, for the love of computer science, do not confuse JavaScript with Java. DHTML, or dynamic HTML. This is the marriage of XHTML plus CSS plus JavaScript to do dynamic sorts of things on a web page. You might recall around October time, We had little bats flying around on the page. That was done with a little JavaScript added to the existing XHTML and CSS. XML, extensible markup language. This is the strict markup language upon which XHTML is based. And just for fun, let's throw in AJAX, asynchronous JavaScript and XML. A lot of the applications that we've talked to you about all semester, Google Calendar, AJAX 13, which has, like for example, a spreadsheeting and a simple drawing program on the web, they're written in AJAX. And if you are interested, I invite you to view the video of the week on web applications.
AJAX draws from like an external database or something like that?
Actually, no. It's using just JavaScript and HTML and a special way of talking with the web server to redraw pages such that you don't have to refresh the whole page to see changes. But since we're almost out of time, okay, I'll go over here. Since we're almost out of time, programming. Pardon my handwriting. We want to talk about variables, loops, conditions, and pseudocode. A variable, in essence, is just a container. In algebra, we knew this as x, y, z. If the joke in my school was x was always equal to 8. But in programming, variables don't have to have a name of x. They can have more meaningful names like today's date equals, what's today, the 9th? For example, they're just places where you can programmatically store information. You don't necessarily want to hard code variables because today's date is going to change. If I visited a web page today, I don't want this hard coded because tomorrow it's going to be different. And as a person who owns that web page, I don't want to hard code it either because that means every day I have to change it. We saw plenty of examples of loops with Scratch. This is while. An example of a loop is while some condition is true or false or not true, do something. A condition, David also called it a Boolean, is essentially a programmatic way of saying one or zero. Is a given condition true? If you'll think back to lecture, does socks on feet equal two? Yes or no? Zero, one or zero? And that's useful both by itself and in loops. While socks on feet does not equal two, go to sock drawer and pick out a sock, right? And pseudocode. I think this, frankly, is going to be the significant for you to know for the exam. You don't necessarily need to know hard and fast some syntax, but with the LaBaby example of providing instructions for putting on a diaper, you might, for instance, need to write up pseudocode for, say, a robot to cross the street. What's some examples of this? If robot's not on, turn on. If robot's at the side of the road, look both ways. If the road is clear, go forward. That kind of thing. And you would want to use indentation. So if the first line is if robot on, if robot at road, if road is clear, move forward. The indentation indicating that we're part of a certain code block. Okay, I don't want to keep folks because there is section right now, but if you have questions, we'll reserve a certain amount of time. We'll reserve a few minutes at the start of section to go ahead and deal with those questions. And I invite you to review the lecture notes off of the course website. If it's not too much of a hint, exam one was based almost, in fact, it was based 1,000% entirely on the lecture notes. So if it's there, learn it. Pace yourself when you're taking the exam. Please save the extra credit for last. Do the whole exam first, check your work, and then go to the extra credit. And check out our videos of the week. If stuff here went by a little quickly, we've covered it a lot more in depth in the videos of the week. Thank you very much. Yes? Yeah.
If the robot is not on, would that be number 5 rather than being under if robot on?
Yeah, that it certainly could be. If robot on is no, then we would have an else.
So would it be,
you wouldn't have to place your other ifs first?
Yeah, it would be if robot on, oh, I see, I got it.
Yeah, so if robot is on is true, then we go here. If it's not, we skip down to 5 and say else, something else. I mean, this is pseudocode, so we don't have to do formal things like you might have to do in some other language, like closing ifs. Yeah, that would probably be a very good idea. Here's a hint for both the exam and the homework. A good way of writing pseudocode is to write it as if you were writing for someone who is going to nitpick. You know, we're all old enough that we've dealt with either children or nephews or cousins that are just, well, you said pick up the tray and go into the kitchen. So I picked it up, I put it down, and I went into the kitchen. Treat pseudocode like that because that's how we're going to pick it apart.